Hello, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teeny.
And I'm Laura, and this podcast is about our favorite things in the world.
Alcoholic beverages. Now, if you guys have listened to this podcast at all, you know that we do a fair amount of drinking. Yes, and I get a lot, and I'm sure, Laura, you do too. When I'm out working in the industry, tell people that I'm a beer professional, a lot of people look at me and are like, oh, so you just get to drink for work all the time. Your life is so hard. But there's really more to it than that.
There is, especially working through the service industry and studying for some of these tests. Drinking is like a... the least part of it. Actually, I've started spitting and like tasting.
Oh, wow, you are growing up.
You're like,
he's so grown.
So grown up. But yeah, there is. It's and categorically a lot of stuff going on too. If you want to be known as an expert in the field, so yeah, we're studying for two different kinds of certifications. You and me. I'm doing the sommelier certification.
And I'm doing the BJCP, although this may be up in the air, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But the certification part of this is why we even really started this podcast, because
Absolutely.
We were doing a lot of studying, a lot of drinking, a lot of not remembering. And also, like, it's really hard for me to work studying into my lifestyle now that I'm an adult.
Totally.
Which is why I actually recently started a class so that I don't have to do independent study. But
neat.
So the certifications that we're talking about, the BJCP, that stands for Beer Judging Certification Program. And there's another sort of tandem program called the Cicerone Program, which is much like the sommelier certification for wine. And Laura, yours is technically the sommelier certification with the Court of Master Sommeliers?
That is true. Okay. So the Court of Master Sommeliers does a sommelier certification, which is similar to Cicerone in that it's very service elements part of it, in addition to the, like, the actual wine knowledge.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, there's tons of other certifications you can get through different guilds as well. So I'm going to break some of that down today.
Awesome. Well, before we dive too deep into exactly what these certifications are and why you may or may not need them, why we're even doing this, Laura, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, today I have a Sauvignon Blanc from Jurassic Ridge Winery in Waiheke, New Zealand.
Ooh.
And it's actually grown in Marlboro. But so I chose this wine today for two reasons. The first is because I was inspired by us talking about this certification process. And a couple years ago, when we first decided we wanted to do this, I did a dinner with you and one of our other friends. And I brought three Sauvignon Blancs and we tasted them side by side and really kind of started digging into the nitty gritty differences.
Yes,
and
I remember this. This is when I discovered that I liked Sauv Blanc from New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they are, it's very different from Sauv Blanc from, like, say, California. So, I chose it for that reason because, I'm, like, remembering. And then I also chose this one because I picked this up when I was traveling earlier this year, living in New Zealand and Australia.
So. Oh, you actually got this in Australia?
Yes. Well, in New Zealand.
We were
in Auckland for my spouse's job. And we took the scooters on the ferry and went over to Waiheke Island and drove them around and stopped at this Jurassic Ridge Winery and met one of the growers and did a, like, basically private tasting with them because there's
That's
no one
amazing.
Else up there. Yeah, it
that
was super
so
cool.
Fun.
And then so had all these wines shipped back to us. So that's
cool.
What I brought today for you.
An excellent, most excellent souvenir.
Yeah, and we'll talk a lot more about what this wine tastes like in a little bit later in this episode.
Okay, we'll save it. I'll save the surprise.
Yeah. Deanie, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
So today I am drinking a Pilsner Urquell. When I first started studying for the BJCP, I was required to learn about specific styles. And so the first one that came up in my notes was the Pilsner. Now, this was a style I hadn't really revisited in a while because it kind of gets a bad rap in America with, like, the Bud Lights and the Miller Lights. Like, all of those are technically Pilsners.
Gotcha.
But this Pilsner, Pilsner Urquell, is the original Pilsner. And what I learned through learning about Pilsners is that they're actually quite hoppy beers, but they're not bitter at all because the hops are added at a point where they add more, like, aroma and floral notes rather than actual bitterness.
Okay.
So Pilsner Urquell, this hails from Pilsen in the Czech Republic and dates back to 1838. As the story goes, some Bohemian brewers developed the style. Yeah.
I love that word.
Bohemian Pilsner is like a type of thing. So
Bohemian brewers, go on.
And their flowy skirts. And, yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
Sounds like it, yeah.
So these brewers, they actually developed the style after they made some beer, and it was so bad that they decided to dump it in the streets. And what they did is they trekked down to Bavaria, tracked down some brewers there, and they were like, hey, teach us this thing called lagering so we don't have to throw out any more horrible ale. And so the brew was so popular that the style actually adopted the name from the city where it started.
Mm-hmm.
And though Pilsners vary slightly from place to place, depending on the water makeup and obviously the sort of native ingredients that other countries have to use. So like a German Pilsner is not the same thing as a Czech Pilsner. Yes. In fact, I have two in my fridge. So later this week, I'm going to like do a side by side tasting so I can like taste the difference, because as we'll talk about in a little bit, the testing for the BJCP and the Cicerone is so specific, like you need to know those differences.
Yeah.
So anyway, I really love this beer. It renewed my interest in Pilsners and my love of Pilsners. This specific beer in my hand, however, it was not brewed in Pilsen. It was brewed in Fort Worth. As we've talked about, Miller Coors down here brews several different styles that would be easier to distribute, you know, from here rather than import.
Totally.
And so Pilsner Urquell is one of the 18 styles in the Miller Coors brand portfolio.
Wow.
So not from Pilsen, but it tastes amazing. They adjust their water and all that sort of stuff.
Neat.
I look forward to going to the Czech Republic and sort of comparing, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, like, let me know when you go. Yeah. I'm coming also.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That was a good one.
That was a good one. All right. Well, so let's define some things as we get into this. So the first thing I wanted to find is a sommelier. So when I tell people or people find out I'm going through the certification process, the first question I get asked is, what is a sommelier?
Okay.
And what is that?
Okay. So is that how you pronounce it too? Because I'm always sort of like shooting in the dark, I feel like.
Yes, it is. So the word is sommelier, and it is pronounced sommelier, not
sommelier.
Sommelier.
Man, you look familiar.
Yeah. I could see the confusion, though. Absolutely. I'm not great at French pronunciation, typically. So, simply put, sommelier is a wine steward, someone who works with wine. It's that person in a nice restaurant who is the expert on wine, who comes to the table and helps you pick a glass or a bottle to go with your meal. And they're a lofty goal, I suppose, in a restaurant is to accentuate the experience of the guests with, like, the perfect wine.
That's hilarious. So, that's almost, like, verbatim what the Cicerone website says.
Oh, that's so funny. That's so funny. So, yeah, a good sommelier will help guide your experience through picking a wine that suits your taste and your budget and won't make you feel pressured or dumb if you don't know what you're doing. And a sommelier could also be in charge in a restaurant of building or managing a cellar, ordering supply, inventory, staff, wine staff education, and being an extra set of hands just during the dinner service while you're there as well.
Okay.
So that is what a sommelier is and does. It is very service-based. So the next question I get is, do you need to be certified to be a sommelier? So honestly, you could probably find a low-level job or a mid-range restaurant and start off working as a sommelier without actually being certified, as long as you really know your stuff and the right people to find that.
Yeah, like people who know that you know your stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But if you want to advance in industry or work in a big restaurant with a big reputation, I would say yes, you probably do want to go ahead and get certified. And then what level of certification you have as well can also affect your pay range. So
okay,
pretty big jump if you take it to the next level.
If you're like higher certified.
Yeah, like advanced and master, obviously, but not obviously. But yeah, if you're an advanced or master, you can make a lot more as just like a certified or uncertified. And to build off of that is, do you need a sommelier certification to work with wine? And the answer is no. You can get all kinds of jobs in wine as far as growing, making, selling in the industry without the certification.
Oh, cool. Okay, so like if you were to harvest or anything like that.
Yeah.
Are there certifications for that type of thing? Or
I
they're
mean,
not wine
you
related?
Can get viticulture degrees, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. Like you can get associate's degrees or, you know, in working in the vineyard, but it's not the same type of certification.
Okay.
And it's not necessary to get any kind of certification like that for many jobs in the industry. Yeah, so why do it?
It sounds like, if you really want to work your way up in hospitality, question mark?
Yes. So, and if you're working your way up in hospitality, you kind of want to, like, prove how much you know. So this is a good, like, standard level of bar set across the world for other professionals to know, like, where you stand and how much you know.
Sure.
Yeah, hospitality. I have a ton of notes on that. Yeah, I started hosting private wine tasting a couple years ago as a side hustle, and people definitely trust you more and that you know what you're talking about when you have, like, these little letters or, like, certifications after your name as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's why you want to do it. So let me – any questions before I get into what it is exactly?
No, I think that
– Okay, cool.
I'm following.
Okay, perfect. So – I want to start by saying that there are a couple different guilds that do the certification for sommeliers. The one I'm doing mine with is the Court of Master Sommeliers, or CMS.
Sounds fancy as fuck.
It is. And it's the one with the most clout, the most name recognition, the most, like, street cred, if you will. So that's why I ended up choosing it. So, and the idea for a guild of wine professional is, like, super old. Do you remember the tradition we talked in another episode begins around the early 1300s? When the groups of companies in London kind of built guilds for themselves to protect them because there was no government assistance if they, like, fell in hard times.
Mm.
So there was a guild of vintners, wine growers, and winemakers was one of those 12 companies. And that evolved eventually until the 1950s when they, as a company, decided to test people in the professional industry. So they gave 21 people an intensive exam on all things wine, and only 6 people passed it. And those 6 individuals who passed the exam started an organization called the Institute of the Masters of Wine. And that's really what kind of kicked off this whole idea and trend of, like, certifying people and testing people and, like,
to make sure they prove, like, make them prove that they know their shit.
Yeah, it's, like, a relatively recent phenomenon, I would say, in, like, the last 100 years, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. A lot of that stuff is still really new when it comes to BJCP and Cicerone as well.
Right. So the Institute of Masters of Wine tested wine merchants, makers, writers, academics, mainly people who dealt in wine and knew a lot about it, but it did not include members of the service community selling the wine in the restaurants for these wineries.
Mm.
And most beverage associations did not include membership for servers, actually.
Weird.
So in the 60s, in the late 60s, an organization started campaigning for highly educated wine sellers. And in the 70s, 1977, the Court of Master Sommeliers was established. Or it had established itself by that time, I guess I should say, as an international standard for examining wine professionals and service individuals.
Yeah, that's cool.
So through the 70s is when the CMS really came about. And honestly, so many people taking the Quartermaster Sommeliers just, like, weren't passing it. They were all failing it. So Quartermaster Sommeliers made different levels of certification, the intro, the certified, the advanced, and then finally the master.
So, like, the steps up.
Yes.
So it wasn't just like, you pass, you fail. Because, like,
as I'm
learning, some of these tests are so expensive. So it's
so,
like,
expensive.
You fail once, like, you might not be able to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really smart that they did that.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, and that's where you hear about the Master Somms. That's the top level and the top tier of the most recognizable guild.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And there is another organization called Guild Somm, which is not to be confused with the Court of Master Sommeliers, which is a very common mistake for people starting out in the beginning. It's just independent
it's like
website.
Two of the three words are
right. Yeah. It is an independent website for study materials for studying for the test for the Court of Master Sommeliers.
Okay.
So that confused me in the beginning. I just wanted to point that out. And there is another guild that does the certifications as well, called the International Sommelier Guild, not to get confusing, the ISG. And when I actually started this journey, I registered for classes with the ISG through El Centro College. I don't know if you remember that.
I do,
yeah. I paid a few grand for this flipping class, and then no one else signed up, and the class was canceled, and I was refunded my money, and it was, like, a whole thing. And that's why I actually got the job at the wine bar that sponsored me to go through my first level of Court of Master Sommelier testing, CMS.
Yeah, you were like, I just want this education.
Yeah, and then the ISG, the International Sommelier Guild, just doesn't have the same kind of history or clout or anything like that. So it's not as trusted as a resource, I would say. And then there's a couple other, those are the two that will certify you as a service sommelier.
Okay.
There are other certifications you can get, like the Certified Specialist of Wine. That's from a society called the Society of Wine Educators. And that is basically, it's just a certificate that says you know a lot about wine and you can educate people about wine.
Okay. So that seems kind of like a, if you wanted to prove that you know something but don't have time or money right now.
Yeah, it's a little bit more affordable. And also it's still a respected certification. Okay. And it's not as like, it's you still have to know your stuff, to be sure. But it's not quite as like in-depth and beating as.
And it sounds like it may not be 100% service focused.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And then there's another one called the WSET, or the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. And that's out of the UK. And that is also not service-based and does not certify you to be a sommelier, but it is very science-based and also a very respected certification as well.
Very cool. So why did you want, if there were all those other options, like why are you pursuing the sommelier path?
Well, to be honest, in the course of my lifetime, I'm probably going to go after all of them. I was just telling Ben before we got started, like, I test really well, and I'm a certification and workshop junkie.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see myself pursuing all of them eventually.
Okay, then why some first?
Yeah, so
you crazy person.
I chose this one, yeah, because I do have quite a bit of history working in the service industry. So that element of it was just like easy peasy, not even think about it, pouring a bottle of wine in a restaurant. And the other thing is, too, is with working at a restaurant and becoming a sommelier, like I mentioned, you could get a restaurant to sponsor you through the first couple levels of certification and pay for your exam fees.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Maybe I should go get a restaurant job.
It was really nice. Thank you, Front Burner.
Yeah.
And then, aside from that, it's, you know, it's just like a fancy little guild and you get fancy little pins and I don't know, it's kind of a clubby club thing.
Not elitist or anything.
Yeah, no. When that all those SOM documentaries came out on Netflix and they said it's really refreshed the pool of people becoming sommeliers, like younger,
oh, cool,
more expansive, broader.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
The more diverse group of voices, the better, in
exactly
my opinion.
I agree totally. So is there an equivalency with the certifications in beer?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about getting certified in beer, there are two main certifications. I mentioned the beer judging certification earlier, but the one that sounds a lot like the SOM program is what's called Cicerone.
Yes,
this is definitely a beer service based and consumer facing certification. And so what the difference here is, I actually just started a Cicerone prep class.
Neat.
Earlier this week. So this is going to be like
congrats.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited.
As
I mentioned, independent study is not really my thing. So what I learned about the Cicerone is that it's sort of a wide picture view of beer, like beer history, beer industry, beer innovation, beer service and keeping and transportation.
Oh, wow.
And basically it comes down to how it's optimally enjoyed. So the official website says that they certify and educate beer professionals in order to elevate the beer experience for consumers.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
So the Cicerone,
I'm into it.
The Cicerone organization is actually really new. It was founded in 2008.
Uh-huh.
Sarah's going to kill me for saying that. It was founded in 2008.
The late aughts.
By a guy named Ray Daniels. And what he wanted to do was really elevate the experience of beer so that, you know, the burden of non-enjoyment is not on the beer per se. And until that time, there was no sort of certification to, like, sort of set beer industry people apart. They were always called beer sommeliers.
Oh,
and so
interesting.
But they couldn't really take the sommelier test or get certified in anything. It was just that the perception was that way.
Yeah.
So he founded this program so they could actually get certified.
Oh, wow.
And
that's pretty recent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And he said, one of his driving quotes, I loved this, he said, too often beer gets ruined from improper storage and handling. So he really wanted to combat that.
Yeah, that, what a crisis. I'm glad he took that up as his crusade and his cause, because that was, I feel like, a really terrible thing the last half century.
First world problems, if I could point out.
Yeah, I mean, yes, get a maybe more meaningful crusade. Maybe make that the frosting on your crusade cake.
It's a good crusade.
Yeah. I mean, here I am. So
yeah.
So because of that, he wanted to really teach about, like, glassware, the proper pour, food pairing, and being able to match people's taste to something that's, like, available on draft.
Neat.
Now, the other side of the coin is the BJCP, and this is a program that's more about the beer itself.
Gotcha.
So you can know all the things about how to serve it, but part of that is knowing also about the beer. And so that's where the BJCP really puts its skills.
Mm.
It's more science-based.
Gotcha.
It's also a little older. It was started in 1985 and aims to promote beer literacy, beer appreciation, and as well as mead and cider, and then also recognize tasting and evaluation skills. Mm. So within the BJCP, you can become certified beer taster, cider taster, or mead taster.
Oh, wow.
And there are levels to all of those.
Neat. Okay. Yeah. I had no idea.
So the cider and the mead are like a little less popular these days.
Yeah, but I had never heard of that. I've heard of both of the certifications a ton, but I didn't know about the cider and the mead.
Yeah. So the BJCP also sanctions competitions. They've done more than 9,200 of them, and they provide judges for those competitions. Mm. They also have the duty of defining beer styles. So the BJCP guidelines are the official rule of law written for beer styles. And conveniently, they also have an app. So if this is something you want to like take with you, I keep it whenever I'm sitting down and I'm like, what is that flavor? I can like pull it up in the BJCP app.
Mm.
So they really focus on judging a beer by experiencing the full sensory analysis of it. So you should be able to pick out the beer's attributes just beyond what style is this. You're supposed to know, like, what kind of malts are in it, what kind of hops, where does the sweetness in this beer come from, or the mouthfeel or the aftertaste. You want to be able to trace the beer's perceptions down to the ingredients to tell what is both right with the beer and also what might be wrong with a beer.
Mm.
So it's really great for those who are working in a brew house to be able to pick these things out, because before the beer even finishes, you'll be able to tell what may or may not be right with it. So you can adjust it before fermentation is finished or anything like that.
Very practical.
You can see if there like unwelcome bacteria has made it in, if you need to sanitize something. And then as far as judging is probably the least serious or crucial piece of this whole thing, because beer competitions are important and they use a mass amount of judges, but a lot of them are also sort of like, there are a lot of homebrew competitions and it's really sort of a friendly environment.
Cool.
So no one, when they're judging your beer, is going to be like, this is an embarrassment to the style, or like, I don't know. I feel like if there were a wine competition, like maybe there could be a little bit of trash talking on the score sheet.
I feel like no.
Well, there's like actually a rule. So we'll get into the score sheet in a little bit. On the sheet, there are like brackets of points, and certain points mean this is an exemplary style or this one is not. And
inadequate to pour.
Yeah, 0 to 13 points is like, this beer sucks a nut. And so you're never supposed to give less than 13 points. Because like, if you get a 13, they get the point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like it's very arbitrary to take it to like a 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Like unnecessary pettiness.
Unnecessary roughness.
Well, cool.
So I guess I can talk a little bit about how I got into this.
Yeah. What was your path? We've heard about my path into wine, but you were writing about beer for the paper in Dallas. And then so you were just like, more.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to say that I started pretty renegade, just drinking a lot. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I started studying for the BJCP officially like at the beginning of 2018. But I had wanted to for so much longer than that. As you know, my beer vocabulary I felt was running a little dry. But there was also an element of like wanting to truly know what I was talking about, being a reporter in the beer industry, and not just a reporter, but like a female also.
I feel like you got, not to like go on this like soapboxer campaign, but I feel like you got like double amount of some of like the shit online from like the comment sections. You know what I mean?
Well, in the beer scene, there's a lot of opportunity to get mansplained.
Yeah.
And then as on the other side of it, as a journalist too, within the building, my legacy newspaper organization, you know, it took a long time for people to realize that I was reporting things that were real and meaningful and about industries and legislation. And it wasn't just like, she drinks. That's what she does. Let her do her thing. You know what I mean?
Totally. So full spectrum.
Both of those two things, I really wanted to know that what I was talking about, because
absolutely,
I want to be respected, you know? And too often, you know, there are people who just, based on your gender, assume you don't know anything about beer. Anyway, exit soapbox on that.
Yeah.
Be kind to your beer drinking friends who are females.
We're all learning. We all had to start somewhere, you guys.
But as I mentioned, the BJCP is very much an independent study situation, and that doesn't jive with my lifestyle. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to this class that I'm taking. I find that there are a lot more study groups and actually structured classes around the Cicerone versus the BJCP.
Great. Yeah.
I'm not really sure why that is, but I'm glad to have found one.
Yeah. Very awesome. Well, that was a lot of meaty substance. Do you want to take a quick break before we break down what these exams entail?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to wet my whistle. And then if you're interested in taking these exams and you're listening, get ready to take some notes. We're really going to break down the program, what's going to be expected of you, so you can be prepared for that. So.
Absolutely. And then you can also go to our website at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to find some resources and materials with our corresponding blog post for this episode. All right. See you soon.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love making this show, and we hope you enjoy listening to it, too.
That's right. And we want to give a huge shout out to our very first Patreon donor, Jeremy.
Whoop, whoop. Jeremy was so kind to pledge at the happy hour date level, which means he gets a shout out on air, as well as an invitation to our postseason happy hour.
If you want a shout out on air, you can pledge as a drinking buddy. And to be invited to our end of season happy hour, donate at the happy hour date level. And to really knock our socks off, our top tier is Pick Your Poison, where donors can pick a topic for an upcoming episode.
Go to patreon.com/grapesandgrain to pledge your monthly contribution today.
Cheers, y'all. All right, guys. Well, welcome back. That was a great break. Stretched our legs and stuff.
It actually did not move. So.
Nice stroll around the block.
Yeah.
Let's kind of dig deeper into what these exams and certification actually are and what they consist of.
It's a long road. It's been a long road for us just like studying and preparing to take this.
This has been an already like 3 to 4 year process, and I am just at intro level sommelier. I still have a year left to take my certified, and then, you know, it's a decades long course for sure to really become a master of this trade. So I want to start by breaking down the four different levels of certification within the Court of Master Sommeliers. That first one we were talking about, the one that I am in.
The one of the most popular, I feel like. Yeah. It's the one I hear most commonly.
The one in the documentary of Somme, and I haven't seen the show Uncorked, but I imagine it is also that because I think it's a journey as well to the Master Sommelier level. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned before, there's four levels of the test. And I have to say, when you go to the exams to take the test, sometimes they're with like a weekend long workshop. But do not really rely on that to learn your stuff. Like, you have to know your stuff before you go.
Is it more just like refresher course?
It is. It's like a crash course before you. And I mean, you only need 60% to pass, which is like, oh, wow, it's not that bad. Only 60%. But I mean, that's also a statement. And like, there's so much flipping information. Like, if you know 60% of it, like, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah.
So with that being said, four levels. The level one, the one that I've completed, is the introductory certificate. That is a 2-day crash course with the exam at the end consisting of a 70-question multiple-choice exam about wine styles and regions, and actually a few questions about spirits popped up as well.
Ooh, that's
so
fun.
And that's pretty, there's a 90% pass rate of the people who take it, and that costs around $500.
Whoa, okay. Yeah,
already expensive out of the bat.
Well, if most people pass it.
Yes, most people do. If you work with wine or work in the service industry, you can probably pass us.
Okay.
Level two is the certification. So the certified sommelier. That exam consists of three parts, a blind tasting, a theory of the test, and then the service that we spoke about as well, like a mock service.
Mm-hmm.
So the blind tasting, you taste 4 to 6 wines and you must demonstrate that you know the deductive tasting method, which we'll cover a little bit later, which is the tasting rubric for the Court of Master Sommeliers. And then that also has a 60-question multiple choice, 45-minute service role-playing element. And it's a pass them all or pass nothing. You don't get a piece of it.
Oh, dang.
So, yeah, you have to...
Not even the different sections?
No, yeah, you gotta pass them all when you're there.
Okay.
So,
how long does that take?
The weekend.
Okay.
A few days. And they added the certified level in 2005 because the pass rate for the advanced certificate, which is level 3, was so low.
Well, yeah, you can't go from intro to advanced. We need an intermediate.
Yeah, it makes sense. So the level 2 has a 64% pass rate and it costs around $500.
Okay.
Level 3 is the advanced certification. So you are already a certified sommelier and you are now trying to take it to the next level, boost your income, your clout within the industry. It's extremely advanced and intensified version of level 2, adding to the styles and regions. You must also know producers and start getting an idea of years and vintages as well. It also consists of a blind tasting, theory, and service test, and has an extremely low pass rate, but I could not find an exact number on that.
Oh, wow.
And it costs $1,000 to take.
Wow, we are eating into my savings really quickly.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think you get to, like, take them, like, if you're a millionaire, I don't think you just get to take it, like, 40 times. You have to wait, like, a year to take it again, and it's a whole thing. And most people have to take the advanced certification test more than once. And then the level 4 is a master sommelier, which is what gets all the buzz. Mm-hmm. You hear all about that. And level 4, I mean, at that point, like, you are the wine. You know everything there is to know about wine. You live and breathe wine. Wine feeds your babies. It's like a... It is what you do. It's who you are.
It's wine in your veins.
Yes. So, and that also has a 3-part exam, the blind tasting, the questions and theory, and then the service. And it is considered the top level of certification in the world with wine. And you must be invited or recommended to sit for the exam.
Oh.
And there are only 200, approximately, this might have changed by the time this airs, but like 236 master sommeliers certified in the world. So.
Wow. That's really incredible.
Yeah.
You have to be invited to take the exam.
It's very competitive. It's very dedicated work.
Does that one cost anything, or did it be the invitation?
You know, I don't know. I didn't come across a cost like that.
But you'll know when you know. If you don't know, then you don't know.
Yeah. If you don't know, then now you don't either.
Yeah.
I had to rewrite that in my head.
Yeah.
So that was with the Court of Master Sommeliers. The International Sommelier Guild, the other certifying guild, is more course-driven than independent study. So all of that, your independent study, you're studying with a quartermasters or with a mentor at a restaurant.
Okay.
Or within the industry. The ISG, International Sommelier Guild, is more of a classroom-based certification with standardized published materials and all that good stuff. So that only has 3 levels of certification. The level 1 is called the IWC, or Intermediate Wine Certificate. It's your intro certifying course, 500. Level 2 is the Advanced Wine Certificate. That costs $1,000.
Okay.
And you're still not certified at that point with level 2 until you take the level 3, which is a sommelier certification, a course, an exam, and that costs $5,000.
What?
So
okay, that one seems like a fucking money grab.
It is a money grab.
I just gave you $1,500 and I'm not certified for anything.
Right. And not only is it a money grab, it has a 4th certification, which enables you to teach for the ISG itself. So it's like its own self-fulfilling, like, machine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it feels a little gimmicky in that sense. I would agree. Like, the Quartermaster Sommeliers is just feels more like it's going for the excellence in wine. And, like, the ISG is, like, a self-sustaining, like, business kind of,
sure.
It feels like. And then the same thing with the CSW as far as, like, an independent business and, you know, membership-based. The similar with the Certified Specialist of Wine. They do not certify you as a sommelier, but they do certify you to educate about wine as well.
Okay.
They start off with a hospitality and beverage specialist exam. Like, you just know your tea and coffee and hospitality. That's $100. And then you can take your certified specialist of wine exam for $850 and then become a certified wine educator as well for another $1,100. And then the WSET out of the UK. So I have this one in pounds. The WSET has 4 levels.
I was looking at these notes, in my head, it's always WSET.
WSET, I know. And that's, they actually commented on that in some of, like, the articles I read breaking down the differences between it. They're like, I think in Europe and UK, they might call it USET or something instead of WSET.
Oh.
Or I don't know, or something like that. But they mentioned that that's an awkward string of letters.
Gotcha. Yeah. I like it.
But that one consists of 4 levels as well. And it is the most similar, I would say, like, to BJCP the way it is to Cicerone.
Mm-hmm.
The first level is just called an award in wines. Costs about £185. Intro test. Level 2 is an award in wine and spirits. Intermediate costs about £500.
And I think the exchange rate is, like, it's almost double.
Yeah, I don't know. It changes quite a bit, but it's never usually great with a pound for us.
Yeah.
Like, we usually are on the losing end of that one.
Yep.
And then level 3 is level 3 award in wines. It is the advanced level qualification, and you have a detailed understanding of grape growing and winemaking. That costs 550 pounds. And then the last one is a level 4 diploma in wine and spirits. And I mention this more emphatically because this is considered the equivalent, the closest to the equivalency of a master's of wine sommelier certification. You have a lot of coursework and assignment on theory, multiple choice exams, blind tastings as well, written essays, and spirit element of the exam with tasting and essays as well, sparkling wines, and fortified wines also. So it's a very in-depth scientific base.
Comprehensive, for
yes.
sure.
And that costs 3,500 pounds to take. And so that is like the master of the non-sommelier path, and the master of the sommelier is the master of the sommelier path. So those are the two highest level. And when you get both of those or either of those, then that qualifies you for the golden elite status.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I know. This is really crazy, right?
It's drum roll.
Yeah. Do you remember I mentioned earlier the ISW, the Institute, or the, I'm sorry, IMW, the Institute of the Masters of Wine?
Yes.
They were the first ones coming out of the old, yes, Vintners Guild. If you are considered a level 4 WSET or Master Sommelier, you can then take the be invited for the exam to become a get a Master's of Wine, a Master's of Wine certification with the Institute of Masters. And that's a whole different thing.
Whoa, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and that's also extremely rare. There's only 340 people in the world who have the Master's of Wine.
That still seems kind of like a large number.
Well, I mean, I guess, fuck it. At that point, if you're already a master of wine, like, fucking go for it. Yeah. Like, why wouldn't you just get both then?
I mean,
I guess there are people that have one without the other, though, too.
I need a benefactor to become a master of wine is what it sounds like.
I know.
Hashtag sponsor me.
Yeah, exactly. Visit our Patreon page, y'all. So I do want to just, like, quickly touch on some of the salary. If you are a master sommelier within the CMS.
Oh, yes. Can you get your money back?
Yes, you can, because as soon as you walk out of that test store with a passing little pen, there are people there waiting to give you jobs for like $150,000, $200,000 a year. Just
Whoa.
Like as soon as you, they're just waiting to hire you at the end of the test.
That's amazing.
So that's neat. even the advanced sommelier, though, with the CMS could be making $75,000 a year. And obviously you can work whatever job you want if you have that title. You know? So, yeah, that's what I got about that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that was quite a trip. Let's see if I can.
How does that break down for the beer?
Yeah. So let me start with the BJCP. So this is the one that's going to be like WSET, more about the beer itself. The whole process starts with an online entry exam. And that is going to be 70% of it is going to be like style questions about beer. And then 30 to 40% of it, the questions are going to be about the actual brewing process.
Wow.
So
okay.
It's like true, false, multiple choice. And you'll have 60 minutes to complete it. You either pass or fail.
Nice.
And you pass that first, but you're not certified yet. That just gets you up to the next level.
Oh, right. That's like, gotcha.
Get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And then so the next part, you would do a judging exam, which is an in-person tasting of 6 beers like you would do at a competition. So they would probably all be the same style and you would, or maybe they wouldn't. Don't quote me on that. They might be different styles, but you would judge them like you were at a beer competition.
Right.
So you would use the score sheet, you would write down your impressions, and then someone actually goes through and grades your assessment of these beers. And then now you're in. So you have 90 minutes to do that, and that makes you a certified beer judge. But there are different levels of that as well. So after you're a certified beer judge, you can take a written test exam to sort of level up. So the different levels in BJCP are apprentice, and this is if you got 60% or less on your judging exam.
Gotcha.
So when they grade your papers, you like didn't get above a D. Recognize means that you got 60% or higher on that initial judging exam.
Okay.
Certified means that you got a 70% plus 5 experience points. And what experience points are judging in the field. Mm. So there is one of the biggest homebrew competitions in the nation is here in Irving. It's called the Blue Bonnet Brew Off. And they do. Yeah, isn't it cute? they judge beers for about 6 weeks before the festival. And so whether you're certified
awesome.
Or not, you can go in there, help them out. Because there are so many different categories and so many entries. And so that's how you gain experience points.
Very cool. Are you going to do that this next year?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
So certified, that's certified. And then national means that you took the written exam, which is, also includes an extra 20 true false questions. And then you need an 80% and 10 experience points.
Okay.
And then there is a level called affiliated, but this is sort of an inactive membership to the BJCP exam. These are apprentices. So if you did not get a good grade on your judging exam, you have to retake it within 2 years.
or you get demoted, basically. Gotcha. And you're, like, in inactive status.
Gotcha.
So judges that have already attained a BJCP judge rank via one path and then attempt one of the other paths, so like cider or mead, their ranking does not get reduced to apprentice. It's just like it's a completely separate certification.
Okay. So, well, that's good.
Yeah. Now, the exam retake policy is also a little interesting. You can take multiple of the certifications at a time. So you could say I could take the beer tasting one today and the cider tomorrow.
Okay.
But until I get my grades back, I can't retake either of those.
Oh, okay.
And what's really cool about this is it's super affordable. So I guess they're always looking for beer judges.
Yeah.
The entrance exam is $10 online, whether you're a member or not. Mm. The judging examination is $45 if you're not a member, $15 if you are a member. And then the written proficiency exam doesn't cost anything.
Oh, wow.
And those are pretty standard for cider and mead as well.
That's really affordable.
Yeah, right? So
wine should take note.
That's why I kind of wanted to do it, because I was really trying to learn about the beer itself. But now that I'm in the Cicerone prep class, I'm kind of like, well, should I just do that? Since I would need to take the intro test.
Yeah.
The course ends when the next certified Cicerone exam is. So
well, that's convenient.
I'll have to decide. But
why not both?
Yeah, maybe. So here's the breakdown of the Cicerone.
Yeah, please.
The level one is actually a certified beer server. So this is an online test. It's 60 questions and you need 75% to pass. And that cost $69.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the level two is the actual Cicerone. It's a 4-hour in-person test that is comprised of written, tasting, and demonstration portions. So sounds a lot like
It does.
The sommelier. 2,500 people in the U.S. have achieved this. But it's pretty costly. So the first time you take the exam, it's going to cost you $395.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you need to retake either the tasting or the demonstration portions, they're going to cost you $100 and $175 each.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So what this test covers is the keeping and the serving the beer.
Mm-hmm.
It also tests you on beer styles, evaluation and flavor, beer ingredients and the brewing process, beer and food pasting, and beer and food pairing.
Awesome.
So, and then the tasting test is really interesting. This is something I just learned this week. What they have you do is it's three different portions, and one of them is you have to detect the off flavors.
Mm-hmm.
In the second portion, you have to pinpoint the exact style out of two answers. So, like, is this a German Pilsner or is it a Czech Pilsner?
Ugh. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And then they'll give you a flight of beer, and you have to decide if... I know, right? Where's the drinking in this whole thing?
Yeah. Then right.
out of this flight of beer, you have to decide whether or not these beers are appropriate to serve, because the prompt is basically like, hey, a guest at your restaurant sent this beer back. Taste it. Is it appropriate to serve? Why or why not?
Mm, okay.
Based on, did it come from a bottle or draft? And they give you the beer, the style, and whether or not it was served on bottle and draft. But some of them are spiked with the off flavors.
Oh.
But some aren't. And so you got to say, oh, okay, is this oxidized? Well, it couldn't be oxidized because oxidation only happens in bottles.
Right.
So this beer came from draft, so it wouldn't be oxidized. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's all just to be like a regular Cicerone.
Right.
The level three is the advanced Cicerone, and this was actually introduced in 2015 to denote an expert level of knowledge about beer. Mm. And it was introduced because there was, again, a huge gap between the intro level, or I guess the level two Cicerone certification and the master Cicerone.
Yeah.
So that is a day-long exam with written, oral, and tasting components, and you have to accomplish all of those different pieces, whether you need to retake them or not. They have to be done in a 3-year period.
Mm.
So the first time you take the test, it's going to be $7.95, and if you need to retake the tasting, it's $2.50, and to retake the written portion of the exam is $3.75.
Wow, okay.
So, like, again,
budget, study.
If you guys have some extra cash lying around, want to sponsor me through this program, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and then the Master Cicerone, this is the highest level. I think we're sensing a trend here.
Yeah.
it's a 2-day test in person in Chicago, and it only happens once a year, and it includes multiple written, oral, and tasting components. It is $9.95 the first time you take it, and
the
retakes.
The low price of $9.95.
Yeah, $9.95. Call now, and you'll get the retake for $7.95.
Yeah.
So obviously, what I find interesting is there is a huge financial barrier to entry into the Cicerone program.
For,
you know, so I'm not surprised that there are only like something like 16 Master Cicerones.
in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, too. I'm not surprised there's not a lot. I'm surprised there's so much fewer than wine, I would say. But maybe it's just not as, like, yeah, known as about. Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's a brand new program. It's only 11 years old at this point. All right. So
I guess I'll get off its ass. Yeah. It's slacking.
We're working on it.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. That's a lot of great information.
So, okay. Teeny, yes. What opportunities are opened up for a master?
Yeah, master cicerone.
So
they're waiting at the door for the wine.
Yeah, I've not heard that is a thing for cicerones. I honestly don't think that, like, the enthusiasm around beer has reached a place where people are dying to go to a gastropub because of the beer service. Beer is still, like, yeah, very... And I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just not hanging out with the right people. But
maybe.
I still feel like this kind of certification and the momentum around beer as an elevated product is just not there yet.
Yeah.
Did you ever find in your studies, like, how many hours it took roughly of studying to become a master cicerone or a master of one of these?
Nope. But I'm taking a 17-week course. And even that, the guy who's teaching it is like, these are all of my custom notes and worksheets and all of this. And still, you're going to have to, in addition to coming to this study class more. 3 hours a week, do all of this homework and taste on your own.
Yeah. Oh, I've heard, like, somewhere like 2 to 3 hours a day for, like, a couple of years. And I forget what book it is, maybe like a Malcolm Gladwell book called, like, Tipping Point. It basically states to become an expert in any field, you have to dedicate 10,000 hours to it. And I found a lot of references to that that were basically like, yep, prepare to.
Makes sense to me.
Prepare to give yourself 10,000 hours. Well. Let's take a 10,000-hour break really quick.
And get to the good stuff. Yeah. We're going to do some tasting now, guys. Yay. So grab a beer and join us.
Yep.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love creating this show for you, and we hope that you guys enjoy listening to it, too.
That's right. And if you're a retailer or a producer and would like to have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment,
What You Drinkin'?
Send us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain at gmail.com.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution to help us keep doing this.
Cheers, y'all.
Hey, welcome back.
Welcome, welcome.
Well, now that you know that we're not just drinking our lives away,
yeah,
we thought we might just drink our lives away.
Yeah. Now finally to the fun bit.
Yeah.
When you're asking yourself, when does the drinking come in? It's now.
Yeah. And, Laura, you mentioned a process called deductive tasting earlier.
I did.
That seems like a really, if that's a wine-specific term, I would like to broaden its scope because it just seems like a really great phrase in general.
It is, yeah. It's not assumptive tasting or like jump-the-gun tasting. It's deductive tasting. So, and it's one of the main pillars that we spoke about of the sommelier examination. And it is pretty much just the act and the skill of objectively looking at a beverage, a glass of wine, and running through a rubric or a structured tasting notes to make an educated assumption or assertion or guess about what you believe that wine is.
Okay, cool.
Based off what you see and smell and taste.
Yeah, so we've got this, like, Laura passed out these deductive tasting format notes. So if you hear some paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apologies in advance.
Handouts were had. And
fresh
then you can also find a link to this handout that I've handed them on our blog post that corresponds with this episode as well at grapesandgrainpodcast.com. Let's see, where should we start?
We should start with the wine.
Yeah, so I poured each of you a glass of this Sauvignon Blanc that we started the What You Drinkin' segment with. So I thought we would just run through this deductive tasting sheet with that wine, because like I said, Blanc is a really great place to start. It's a very distinctive style.
Mm-hmm.
It's why I started there long ago.
Now, is this, are we going to have any structure? Are there like steps we need to walk through to taste this wine, or are we just like tasting and looking and sort of...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm going to walk them through you right now. So the first thing you want to do when you're approaching deductive tasting for the wine is not taste it. You just want to look at it.
Ooh.
So there's a few things you're looking for as you're looking at it. What's the clarity like? Is it really clear and crisp, or is it kind of cloudy and hazy?
This is definitely clear and crisp.
Definitely clear and crisp. What color is the wine? So depending, it's going to be a little different based on white or red, whether it's a straw, yellow, or gold. We're drinking a white wine. So I would say that's a pretty light water white or straw colored wine. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned earlier, you want to have good light when you're doing the tasting to really see, you know, see your stuff. And then you, aside from the main color, you're looking for a secondary color as well. Like in white wines, it's silver, green, or copper. And so those colors will give you a clue as to the age of the wine.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so the more oxidized it is, the older it is, the more oxygen that's gotten to it, the more like rusty or like goldy it gets.
Gotcha.
So you can tell a wine is making a little bit younger if it's green or clear. The other things you're looking for are if you see any bubbles, is there any gas evidence in it? Not maybe so much in this one. Maybe it's like a slight effervescence, like a
tiny, tiny maybe, bubble.
Yeah, very, very small. But it's not like a
bubbly
champagne.
Wine. No.
And the other thing you're looking for is sediments. So a lot of that will give you clues, but we are not making any assumptions from the clues yet. That's the number one pitfall when you start deductive tasting is assuming things as you're going along. So don't do that. That's a big pitfall. So after you look at it, you go to smell, go to the nose. The first thing you're smelling for is, are there any faults in it? Is it a really acidic-y or vinegar smell? That might be some volatile acids or ethyl acetate. Mm-hmm. Is there a funky, yeasty, spoiled smell? So we mentioned it in a previous episode that the yeast that changes sugar into alcohol is Saccharomyces. The yeast you don't want is Brettomyces. So
Brettanomyces.
Brettanomyces. Yeah, but thank you. Brettanomyces.
Unless you're making a beer that you want to taste wild and sour.
Right.
Or actually, that's not even the sour one. That's the funky one.
Funk, yeah.
Horse blanket.
Yeah, and so you don't always want the funk in your stuff. So anyways, you smell
save it for the dance floor.
Yeah, oxidized, like I mentioned earlier. You can get too oxidized as well. And then you're looking for the intensity of the smell. Some of them are really flipping powerful, and some of them just don't smell like anything at all.
This one I'm getting, I find this to be a delicate to moderate smell.
I would agree. This is not a super powerful smelling wine. I would agree totally. So the next thing you're looking for in the smell is fruits. What kind of fruits do you smell? It might be citrus. It might be stone fruits or tropical fruits. So stick your nose in the glass. You have a teeny tiny glass, so it might be hard, but get your nose in there. And that's why the wine glasses are shaped like they are, like that bell, to kind of trap the smells in so you can stick your sniffer in there. So for this, I get citrus for sure. Maybe some green apple. Are you smelling along, Ben?
No, I forgot to get some.
Oh, here. Oh, Ben.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt.
Oh, this is important. Okay, here. Here's my glass.
So I'm getting.
Get your nose in there and take a big old drink. Not a drink.
Up.
Yeah, don't snort it, but get a big old smell of that. So green, right? Green apple, maybe a little even like green peppers. There's maybe a touch of passion fruit. But and this is where it gets really geeky and specific. Not the Caribbean passion fruit or like the Mexican passion fruit that's big and yellow, but like the other passion fruit that's small and leathery and purple with like a tablespoon of fruit in it. They taste very different, and you can get really into like the qualities of the fruit to kind of hone down where this wine might be grown.
Gotcha.
Past the fruit, you're looking for non-fruit characteristics. Is it floral, spicy, herbal, animal-y? Barn-like, yeah. It might have a musky animal scent or a barn-like scent. And some of the like, Italian red wines, you'll find that.
This, to me, is very floral vegetal. Is that right?
Vegetal, for sure. Yeah, and some florals, too. Maybe some white flowers. It's not violets or roses. You know,
no.
You can get, again, it's very specific.
Very, like, I know soft isn't a smell, but it's like
clean, like clean.
Clean, yes.
Yeah, so, and it might sound like, God, this is so silly, like you getting really, like, pontificating these weird terms, but it does. It gives you clues about like the quality of the fruit, what temperature it might have been grown at, what regions are known for that specific flavor. Like all of these crazy words you're really trying to find are helping you build the pathway to your deductive guess about what it is.
I remember you, sitting at my dinner table and you were walking through a tasting with us. It might have been the same one, but except I think there were red wines involved, so it was probably a different one.
We did it a few times.
And
you guys were very patient with me.
Yeah. You were telling me that part of your approach is to name three edible things and then three non-edible things that you smell in the wine.
I was mentored or coached. That's a really great place to start when you're doing your deductive, because a lot of people will spit out a lot of fruits, but you want to look for other qualities in the taste and the smell. We're in smell right now in our chart, but that are not fruit characters and non-fruit characters.
Oh my God. I jumped ahead.
No, you're so, you took
so
a sip.
Good. Yeah.
Throw it out. You ruined it. No, just kidding. So once you do the sight and the smell, making no assumptions, you go to the taste. So it's pretty similar to the smell. You take a sip. There's a specific way to sip it that will kind of spray it all through your mouth. So if you take a little itty bitty sip on the tip of your tongue and then like breathe in a little bit, like suck in a little bit of air.
What?
It like aerates it through your mouth and yeah. you're supposed to give you like a more better sense of the taste and the aroma as well.
Because of
the
your
wine.
Orthonasal and retronasal channels.
There you go. God, see, this is why we're doing a podcast together. I did not know that. So you're looking for the same thing, a few fruit characteristics. Mm. So in this one, I would not say they're very ripe fruit. I think it's pretty acidic.
Totally.
It's, like I said, the green apple I taste again. The for the non-fruit, I'm getting maybe green grass, maybe maybe a green bell pepper.
It's got
maybe
like
a slight minerality to it.
I was going to say roundish. Like, is that like the minerals coming through? It's like...
It could be roundness. What might that be from? Like, is it more of a feel or a taste?
It's more of a feel.
I guess. Might be the body or like the alcohol content of it that feels like so round and viscous.
Yeah. Like apricot-y a little bit.
Apricot is definitely, it's a stone fruit that's commonly found in Sauvignon Blanc. And then past the fruit elements, like we're saying, the taste elements, you get to the structure elements, like you were just talking about. The acids in it, the alcohol in it, the texture, the body. Is it balanced? Is there bitterness? Is there sweetness? And then once you've gone through all of that, the sight, the smell, and then the taste and the structure of it, you can start making your conclusion.
Okay.
So based off of that, we think Old World or New World.
New? I mean, yeah. I think of Old World as Europe. Is that wrong?
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. That is. Old World is typically considered Europe, and New World is typically considered the Americas, South Africa, and Australia.
Okay. Good to know.
And there are differences in, like, the same variety of grape that's grown in the European area versus in Australia.
Absolutely.
You know, there's definitely different tastes. So I would say this one is New World just because it doesn't have any of the stereotypic qualities of a French Sauvignon Blanc. It has stereotypical qualities of more of like a New World, bright, grassy, green, acidic.
Young.
Sauvignon Blanc. Yeah. The
sprightly.
Next thing it asks you is climate. Is it cool, moderate, or warm? Some clues to that. Or if it's higher in acidity, it's probably a cooler climate. If it's sweeter, it's probably warmer because more sugars are able to develop.
Oh, okay. So definitely cooler climate.
Yes, because it's quite acidic.
Yes.
And it is. It's flipping cold down in Marlboro. That's the jumping off point for expeditions to Antarctica out of New Zealand, I learned. It's colder than you might imagine. And so the possible grape varieties, we said, you know, if we didn't know this was already Sauvignon Blanc, it's green, it's grassy, it's citrusy, it's acidic, it's clear, it's light colored. Those are all indicating that that is a variety of Sauvignon Blanc. Possible countries is the next conclusion. Because it tastes more of passion fruit and grass, I would guess that this would be more of a New Zealand or Marlboro region than a California, which will be a little more like grapefruits and lemons and fruit driven than like green grassy driven.
Gotcha.
So that's how your different tasting notes will kind of, and then I mentioned age range as well. That's the last one. Sorry. Age range as well, which based on the oxidation, the color, and clues like that, you can tell how old it might be. So it's not all bullshit. Once you kind of start really deductively picking out clues from the wine, you can tell a lot about any wine just not looking at the label. So
that's amazing.
A lot of information, but it's fun. Once you kind of get the swing of it, it's like a really complicated math problem or like a problem solving. And it's like, you know, you're Carmen Sandiego, like sleuthing it out. You know, it's fun. It's neat when you kind of get the swing of it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was amazing. Thanks for walking us through that.
Oh, please. Yeah. Thanks for meandering through that tasting sheet with me.
Okay. I'm going to pour this beer now. And we're going to do deductive tasting.
With beer.
Well, I just wanted it to be a surprise for you. I guess I can. Yeah. Where is your tasting glass, Laura?
It was this little guy here, I think.
Okay.
Why did you want it to be a surprise for me?
I don't know. Because we may have talked about it recently.
Oh, awesome. Interesting.
Okay. So...
It smells very familiar.
Okay.
Here, let me swish all this Sauvignon Blanc out of my mouth with some water.
Sure. I'll go through a little bit about the BJCP beer score sheet.
Please do.
So as we've talked about, BJCP and Cicerone, yes, they're two different programs, but they are obviously super interconnected. A lot of what you learn for one is going to help you with the other. And part of that, as you have to be a Cicerone, you need to evaluate beer, and that is what the BJCP is all about. So...
What I have in front of you guys is a beer score sheet. What okay. judges do is they put their name, their ID, they write down the category that they're judging and the subcategory. Some categories have some categories. Mm. And then take a much similar approach to what we just did with the wine. So
they get a group of people judging to do like a specific category or subcategory, like, and you just get assigned different...
Yeah, you walk in, you don't get to choose probably, but yeah, you walk sure, in and yeah. maybe today they're judging pale ales. So maybe okay. it's pale ale, double pale ale. I don't know.
I don't really know.
I haven't actually done a professional tasting, but hopefully I will soon.
Ooh, I can't wait
to
hear.
The Bluebonnet is in April. So.
Ooh, slipping up.
Yep, slipping on up. But it's a very similar approach to what we just did. First, you want to take in your perceptions and make a first pass at appearance, aroma, mouthfeel, and taste without thinking too critically about it.
Okay.
And then you want to move into the appreciation phase where you relate your perceptions to the requirements in the style guide. So you will know the style that you're judging. You just won't know the specific beer. And so you're supposed to know the archetype for the style.
Gotcha. That
Judge
makes sense.
It against those characteristics.
Yeah, and not against your like preferences.
Correct.
Yes.
And then the third part is about feedback, offering whoever made the beer some constructive feedback. Not like, this beer sucks.
Yeah. Or yummy, good job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
like,
then
okay.
remember, you're supposed to use the approved vernacular. So
okay.
I have next to me, and I actually should have mentioned this a long time ago, my sort of Bible throughout this entire process of studying has been Tasting Beer by Randy Mosier. I highly, highly, highly recommend it if you guys are looking for like an intro way to learn about the vast array of things that you can possibly learn about beer.
Mm-hmm.
And what he has in this book are several very handy little charts. We've got the A Beer Aroma Spiral, which lists all the different, if you're smelling something earthy, here are the words that you use and they go in sort of
wow.
an order.
Okay.
And then I've also got a malt chart so you can describe the malt character. And then we also have a hop aroma vocabulary spider chart. So
yeah.
these are going to help us as we move through them.
Okay, awesome.
So the first thing you want to do, if you're at a competition, you want to either inspect the bottle where the beer came from,
okay.
or just start by inspecting the beer. So you want to look, what is the color? Is it clear? This one is going
to be a pretty color.
Yeah, let's see. It's probably an amber color.
Yeah.
It's got a fairly good head retention. I poured this a little bit.
Oh,
it's
wow,
got a
yeah.
sharp white foam on top.
Mm-hmm. It's not yellowed.
Right.
Sepia toned.
Exactly.
Is
okay.
that in the approved vernacular? Sepia toned.
Sepia toned? Nope, but we'll make it. So the next thing you want to do is smell the beer, and there are several
okay.
different sniffing techniques. So
okay.
the first is the distance sniff. So
okay.
what can you smell?
Was that when, like, what, 6 inches below you?
Yeah,
or?
Like right by your chin. I get some like bready biscuit characteristics.
Yeah,
with that
very
one.
Slightly, but it's not intense. As
no,
the
not
wine
intense.
Used.
And then the short sniff. So you want to go. Gives you some different elements.
Oh, it does. It almost smells like fruity when you do it like that.
Yeah. The next sniff technique is called the long sniff. So you want to dig your nose in there and be like. Yeah, it's got some of that beautiful malt character on the nose.
It does. You get more like malt caramely when you do the long sniff than you do the short sniff.
Yeah, caramely, maybe a little sweet toasty element.
Toasts.
And then the covered sniff. So cover
okay.
your beer, spin it a little bit, and then...
And then like
ooh,
Jack in the Box, like pop those weasels, stick your face in
that. That to me, I get a lot more
wow.
of the hop character.
Totally.
It smells a little bit resiny, maybe a little piney or citrusy.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. So now that we've done that, we visually inspect the beer, and in our BJCP score sheet, we would write down what we see in terms of aroma, appearance. Oh, no. Just of appearance. So we'll write,
right.
you know,
oh,
this
starts
is
the same way. Starts with just looking first.
Yeah. Brilliantly.
Just take a looky-loo.
Brilliantly clear. Good head retention.
Brilliant. I like that.
Brilliantly clear. The color and the texture. And then now we smell the beer again.
Okay.
Note, what did we just say about the malt, the hops, all the other characteristics that we just sort of walked through.
Right.
And now we taste it. Taste and swish. So you want to take a little sip up front and make sure it envelops your palate so you can get the whole feel.
That makes sense. That's probably something you should do with wine, too, that I didn't mention.
Yeah. You can tell it's got like a medium body, moderate carbonation. It's not too heavy. You write down all of those different things. Your mouth feel. Is it warm? Is it creamy? Is it astringent? Astringent means like dry on the tongue. I don't get a ton of all of these or
no.
of that in this beer.
No.
And then once you go through and you make all your notes, you add up your score. Now, on the left side of your score sheet, there are like several different definitions of different flavors that are possible. Mm. Most of them are off flavors. Not all of them are. So some of them are like grassy, estery. Those refer to the actual tasting notes.
Style specific, right?
Yeah. This beer, I get a little bit of estery notes.
Like a touch. I think that's what some of the fruitiness I got was. But it's not like a banana-y, old bubblegummy wheat beer or something.
No, definitely not. But then there are other ones like musty, metallic. Is it oxidized? Is it sour? Is it yeasty? Mm. Is it astringent? Does it have acid aldehyde?
This is really similar to the other deductive tasting sheet. Yeah.
And so once you go through, then you make your notes, and you always want to write a comment at the bottom, whether it's just thanks or I enjoyed this beer or next time try doing a little bit of this.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Good form.
Yeah. And I just wanted to walk through a couple of the off flavors because
now. Yeah, please do. You've gotten to do a lot of these off flavor tastings.
Oh, my God.
You just did one this week, didn't you?
I did.
Earlier this week, yeah.
Off flavors are a huge part because, as I mentioned, you're trying to taste what's right about a beer, but also what might be wrong with a beer. And so, I forgot to tell you guys what this beer was.
Oh, yeah.
Well, please do, yeah.
I have for you today American Beauty Pale Ale.
Oh, I see. I was surprised. Which those is little Grateful Dead dancy bears, which I love
so much. Dogfish Head beer inspired by the Grateful Dead. And it is a pale ale made with oatmeal. And I think there is some sort of fruit in there, which I think is where the estery character was coming from.
Yeah, what kind of fruit is this?
They made it like hippie granola.
Hippie granola. That's they're funny. Their ideas at Dogfish Head are pretty good and pretty clever and pretty cute and pretty marketable. Marketable, if I'm being honest.
So beautiful. I love that beer. New Hampshire, Rhode Island,
somewhere up there. Yeah,
I think it's Rhode Island or New Hampshire. I can't remember. They all run together. So yeah, talk a little bit about off flavors, just because there are like certain elements.
Delaware.
Oh, Delaware. Sorry. So close.
It's the Samsonite. I was way off.
So some of the off flavors that are commonly found in beer, you will get them sometimes in the aroma. Sometimes you'll get them in the taste. Sometimes you'll get them in both.
Oh,
sometimes you won't get them at all because different people are sensitive to different off flavors.
Uh-huh.
So I've heard of like my teacher through the Cicerone prep class, he was talking about acid aldehyde. He can't pick that out. It's like this green apple smell and taste that is sort of astringent and tart. And so he said that for the life of him, he can't pick it out. But if he opens a beer or like spikes a beer with that, his wife is like running into the next room.
Weird.
So,
wow.
I'll just point out two. One that is really not popular.
Yeah, it's a popular spoilage.
Popular. One people talk about a lot and is apparently not super common, but often common. It's diacetyl. Now there's, have you heard of diacetyl?
Yeah, I know diacetyl.
Diacetyl. It manifests as an artificial butter or butterscotch. Scotch-like flavor. It's actually a compound that is produced by the yeast when they aren't able to attenuate a beer. And what that means is if the yeast can't ferment all the way out, if the yeast do not eat all of the sugars, then it's not fully attenuated.
Gotcha.
So
it's, that's a flavor when the sugars not get fully converted by the yeasts.
Yes. And now not every beer calls for all the sugars to get eaten by the yeast.
Right.
And there, it is okay to have a little bit of diacetyl in your beer, but once it reaches a certain
critical point,
it's considered a super off flavor.
Well, you know, can I comment on the diacetyl really quickly just so...
Let me tell you about what a diacetyl rest is. Because
perfect.
Oftentimes there's a part of the brewing process, like if the beer's not fully attenuated, the yeast go to sleep and they take a nap for a diacetyl rest, and then the yeast wake back up and they eat the rest of those sugars or like enough of them. So
if there is a flavor to go away.
Right. Correct.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's clever. I was just going to say that diacetyl does come up in wine sometimes, and it is like an off flavor, but it's not one that maybe when it's considered off is naturally occurring. So in some cheap Chardonnays or mass-produced Chardonnays, sometimes in Chardonnays you want that like buttery flavor, and it comes from a process called malolactic fermentation, which we've discussed in another episode. But malolactic fermentation is a process, and you have to have the proper chemicals. So if you don't, you can fake it by adding diacetyl to your Chardonnays, which gives them a fake buttery, like movie popcorn butter.
Well,
and I think diacetyl is what's in the movie popcorn butter, like that non-butter oil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's what makes it taste so buttery, even though it's just oil.
So good in that context. So bad in wine context and beer context.
So pretty icky. So really cheap, like mass-produced buttery Chardonnays.
We're
kind of notorious for using that. But anyways, go ahead.
Let's talk about one other off flavor. It's so off. It's disgusting. It's called butyric acid. I had the pleasure of trying this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love these tasting notes. Gross.
Flavor tasting several months ago, and I immediately thought, wow, this tastes like spoiled vegetables, mildew, sour vinegar. It was even one of the tasting notes by the teacher listed vomit.
Yeah, baby vomit. Oil. I was just reading that. I was wondering if, like, those, like, Betty Bots every flavored jelly beans when they do, like, the jelly bean roulette.
Oh,
do
yeah,
they use, like,
probably.
Butyric acid or something to make it vomit.
It was so gross. I almost puked myself. Now, if you have butyric acid in your beer, that is a huge, huge problem, and it notes an infection in the sugar.
Ooh, gross.
So
okay. Yeah, infections definitely probably taste gross.
Yeah, it definitely means something that isn't clean, or sometimes using unpasteurized sugars or fruits can unleash this compound as well. So just...
So it would have bottled that way, not after...
It doesn't happen after bottling.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
So be careful. Ooh.
Yeah.
And you,
yeah,
don't worry. You have to do so many of these off-flavor tastings.
I mean, can it happen after bottling? I don't know. No, I'm not a scientist.
It's an infection with the sugar, so it doesn't really matter what the packaging is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. That's sort of, like, not relevant. But good question, man.
Wowza. Okay.
So that was fun.
Yeah, that was neat. That was a very yummy-smelling beer. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Grateful Dead Bears.
Yeah, I accidentally drank it before I smelled it.
Oh, that's, yeah, rookie mistake.
You missed out on all
rookie mistake.
The bready, biscuity,
caramelly.
I didn't even talk about the hop profile, but it's delicious.
It's like a to mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hop profile. Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, goodness gracious. Mm-hmm. This was a lot of information today. And I will say, I was telling Teenie as we were researching this, this is information to have curated in such a straightforward, broken down way is something I would have really paid a lot of money for to get. So hopefully this will help someone else starting on their journey through certifications in wine and beer. And I guess let's wrap up by just finishing up with, like, what's the point? Why would you even do this? What kind of careers can you get with these certifications?
Well, I mean, we touched on that a little bit, but, like, why don't you tell me, Laura, why you're doing it?
Yeah. So, obviously with these certifications, you can become a sommelier, manage a cellar, open a restaurant. But, honestly, I'm doing it because I know, and, you know, I met Ben, our audio engineer, when we were working in advertising. And when I was in advertising, I just knew I wasn't meant to be there. And, it was not a healthy place for me to be. And I really had some soul searching as that journey ended. And I thought, what brings me joy more than anything in this world? And that's yoga and wine. So I became certified to teach yoga, and I'm now a 500-hour certified yoga teacher. And I also would like to work within the wine industry. But there's just, you know, I have decades ahead of me the rest of my life to either make wine or whiskey or learn about wine or become an academic within the industry. And I don't really know where I want to start. So this seemed just like a really good foundational piece to start with.
Excellent.
So that's why I chose to do. It'll just open up a lot more doors than not having it. Well,
yeah. I mean, as a master Cicerone, not that like that's exactly my aspiration right now, but yeah. Master Cicerones are considered in the industry consultants, educators, and knowledgeable leaders.
Yeah.
And they do that for various organizations. You know, they're expected to be on par with brewers and chefs as professional peers.
Mm-hmm,
I'm not really sure what I'm going to do now. I will probably pursue the BJCP anyway.
Yeah.
But since I am taking the Cicerone prep class, it occurred to me like, I feel like I could probably pass the server exam, and if I'm doing all this work anyway, why not?
Yeah.
I think it will come down to money for me.
Yeah.
I'm just doing this out of pure passion, and I think it will look good on a resume, should, you
surely,
know,
yeah,
beer writing or consulting or
and as
anything.
I was saying earlier with the writers are some of the first people to be certified in some of these wine things. Like, you just want to prove that you know your stuff if you're writing about it, like you said.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Maybe we'll be a Master Cicerone professional podcaster one day. And yeah. Maybe someone will pay us to do this.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
raise a glass to that. Cheers, girl.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on Patreon. Patreon.com /grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
Cheers.
What you drinking?